She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. This show is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, a true leader in the business of sustainability. Excuse me. And we thank them for their support. Talk about a special day for me. We are doing a commercial-free show today, and I am interviewing two women doing incredible work for the planet. Dr. Jane Goodall will join me for the first half hour, and Lisa Carter, Executive Director for the Captain Planet Foundation, will join me for the second half of our broadcast today. Now, please join me in welcoming our very special guest for the first half hour of our show, Dr. Jane Goodall. Dr. Jane, thank you so much for being with us. You can, I'm sure, feel the smile on my face.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And let me do a little bit of an introduction for someone who probably doesn't need it, but Dr. Jane Goodall is a world-renowned primatologist, ethologist, anthropologist, and a UN messenger of peace. She is considered to be the world's foremost expert on chimpanzees and is perhaps best known for her 45-year study of social and family interactions of wild chimpanzees in Gombe Stream National Park, Tanzania. She is also the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and the Roots and Shoots program, which we'll be hearing about. She has worked extensively on conservation and animal welfare issues. Dr. Goodall, welcome. We know the demands on your time are many, and we appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. So let's get right to the questions and use your precious time wisely. So here's my first question. You have been interviewed, you've had thousands of interviews, and asked probably thousands of questions. So my question to you was, when I was talking with your staff before, you know, in the planning of this, is there a question you've never been asked? Is there a best question you'd like to answer that no one seems to get to?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, this has been going on for, well, 60 years now, and I can think of lots of questions I haven't been asked, but none of them are questions I would want to be asked. So I think I can't think of anything that I really want to talk about that I haven't touched on at least briefly before. This has been all over the world.
Right.
You know, I mean, I've been interviewed from China to Africa to from Canada and the U.S. to Venezuela. So
that speaks volumes about the quality of the people doing the interviews. I mean, they hit the issues, and let's move on to an issue that's very important to me, and I know to you. Women leadership and global sustainability, women on climate change and food scarcity. And one might ask the question, given what is seen in the press, where are the women? I mean, I know they're out there, and you know they're out there, but what needs to change so that women are not only more fully able to contribute to our society and to the sustainability of the planet, but to get the global awareness and the news out there of the important work women are doing?
I don't think I can answer that because, I mean, the question is way beyond my ability to change things. My own voice gets out there, and that's because I became known to people from the work with chimpanzees, which was appealing, attractive, exciting. This has never been done before. And then the National Geographic Society came in, and that, of course, took my work out around the globe. And so as a result of that early, you know, those early experiences I was lucky enough to have, I've been able to speak out about things like climate change and so forth. But, of course, there are an awful lot of women, as you say, out there, really important. I mean, go back to Rachel Carson. What a voice she had. And Vandana Shiva now, and a lot of women working on sustainability. How do we bring them out I guess we need more Hillary Clintons and people like that who are in the political arena.
That's a great answer, and that's who I think of, is Vanda Nashiva and, of course, Rachel Carson, the Silent Spring. She was almost the American that started the message.
She
really was. And we need to have, in my opinion, more people, more women's voices. And like I said, we know they're out there, and it's part of answering my own question. Having people on my radio show, having women leaders helps. It's all pumping up the volume. So
right.
When you talk about, you know, global consciousness, from my view, from being Mrs. Green for the past 6.5 years, there really needs to be a major global shift in consciousness so that we do stop living out of balance with nature and rather quickly. What do you think needs to happen to accelerate the process? Do you have any silver bullets or big ideas about what do we need to do? It's like, I'm not putting all the pressure on you, but what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are what we are doing with our Roots and Shoots program for young people. Because although we cannot afford to wait for 8-year-olds to grow up and have a different way of thinking about things, we can have 8-year-olds absolutely influencing their parents and grandparents. I've seen it happen again and again, because it's their future we're messing up. You know, and you hear, we haven't inherited this planet from our parents, we've borrowed it from our children, but we've stolen, we're still stealing. And so working with youth, and as we began our program in 91 with high school students, there are many young people now moving into leadership positions who have been through this program and who do think in a more holistic and sustainable way. So that's what I'm concentrating on. That's what's taking me 300 days a year around the world.
So talk a little bit more about what happens in Roots and Shoots. And it is a global initiative. So you say 91, those kids that were in it, they're growing up and they're ready to step into their world leadership roles. I can't believe it. You started when they were kids. But what? Explain a little bit more about what Roots and Shoots is and what your efforts are.
Okay, well, it began in Tanzania when a group of high school students, 12 of them, I'd been around various schools giving talks, and these were chosen from 9 different schools. And so they were filled with concern for the dynamiting of the coral reefs, the fishing, the fact that government wasn't prosecuting properly the poachers killing their animals in their national parks. They were worried about street children. They didn't think they were getting enough support. They were worried about stray dogs. They were worried about horrid conditions for animals in the market. And could I fix all these things? They also wanted environmental education in their schools, which they didn't have back then. And I said, well, I love Tanzania. I've been here for years. But what about thinking of ways that you might be able to change things? And it was difficult back then because it was a time when the government was very Marxist and rigid. But nevertheless, we got a big group together. And from that meeting was born this program, which basically has as its message, every one of us makes a difference. Every single day we make an impact on the planet, and we have a choice as to what kind of impact we want to make. And from the very beginning, the Roots and Shoots program has required every group, and a group can be 2 kids, but usually it's a class in a school, sometimes a whole school, and it requires that group between them to choose 3 projects to make the world better. One to help people, one to help other animals, because we're animals too, and one to help the environment we all share. And running through it is a theme of let's learn to live in peace and harmony, first of all with each other, between cultures, religions, young and old, rich and poor, between nations, but also between us and the natural world. So from that small beginning in 91, we now have Roots and Shoots programs in 139 countries.
Oh my gosh.
With about 150,000 groups, and a group can be a whole school. We have about 5 schools that call themselves Roots and Shoots schools. And we're working on a way of getting all this together, because it's not about learning about these problems. It's about rolling up your sleeves and getting out there and taking action. And these young people are changing the world every day.
You know, it's one of the things I read in a very recent quote that you said at the University of South Florida. It's young people who will change the world. And even listening to you inspires me. What are you seeing on the faces of young people all over the country that gives you such hope? All over the world. I don't mean the country, all over the world.
Yeah, all over the world. Well, everywhere I go, there are young people, you know, with their eyes shining, and they're wanting to tell Dr. Jane what they've been doing to make the world better, to share their project, to show me pictures, to try and get me out to plant a tree if there's time, and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's seeing, you know, going to when we have group gatherings, which we try to do, you get young people who are different. So you get different colored skin, different cultures, but all working together, all working for a better world.
And it's got to be, it inspires you. I mean, to keep going on. It's like that's the wind beneath your wings, is to see the kids. I could not agree with you more. Even the schools that I visit that have community gardens and they're raising chickens and have to go in on the weekends. It's like these kids are making a difference right here in a little school in, you know, Tucson, Arizona. So from a global...
Yeah, well, you see, let me interject there, that one reason we're growing so fast is that we try to partner. So we have Girl Scout or Boy Scout groups that are whatever their name is, Roots and Shoots groups. So the reason we're trying to do this is because if we can create a critical mass, reach a tipping point of young people who understand that, yes, we need money to live, and it goes wrong when we live for money in and of itself. And to raise lots of money, great, if you use that money to make the world a better place.
So reaching a tipping point, I love that, with kids. I mean, and it's to me, it's giving them hope as well, because the information out there can be daunting, and we could be raising a bunch of depressed young children and this kind of
thing.
We were.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I started Roots and Shoots, because as I was going around the world talking about what we'd done wrong, there were so many, particularly high school, university, even young people out in their first jobs, who literally did not have hope. And they would tell me, we feel depressed, or we feel angry, or mostly apathetic, because you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it. And we have compromised the future of young people and all life on Earth, but there is something we can do about it.
And I think I always add, there is something we can do about it, and you're right, rather quickly. We need to reach that tipping point, because when the reports come out, it's like, okay, we better pump up the volume and hurry, because we're on a trajectory that we need to change.
Yeah, we desperately do.
We desperately do. So given that, given the messages about global warming and climate change and food scarcity, in terms of your global view, what do you see differences of the priority it is given in the United States versus other countries? I mean, who are some of the outstanding leaders? It's actually, to answer my question, it's daunting to me, the lack of acknowledgement, and you know, it's not in the top three priorities in the United States. But what is your global, you know, assessment of countries really caring and getting how important this message is that you're putting out?
Well, to first answer the early part of your comments about, you know, why is it so low down in priority in the United States and in a good many other countries too, like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, UK to some extent. It's the power of the multinationals.
Okay.
It's the vast amounts of money that they can use to suppress the kind of way of living which we must introduce, but which would damage their profits and their ability to take over the world. You know, take agribusiness. Look what's happening there. Look at the control of our seeds and our food. And look at the number of people embroiled in lawsuits because they dare to stand up against some of these powerful companies. And so which countries are doing best? Well, Germany is taking a huge lead in renewable energy. And they've got these vast wind turbines out in the middle of the ocean, which each one costs a lot, but is already providing, I think it's about a third of energy requirements of Germany. It's pretty amazing.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, that is. And they're big on solar. They're great on the way that they build their buildings from the beginning so that they're energy efficient. I mean, that kind of thing really matters. And maybe the you know, the march in New York City will make a difference. I mean, it feels to me in the United States that, and maybe this is the way I have to feel, that there is the beginning of a groundswell of awareness with plastic bag bans and plastic bottle bans. And, you know, it has to start somewhere. So hopefully, you know, this...
It has started.
It has started. We have to do that. Well, in your life's work, were there any formative or outstanding experiences that provided direction for you or even changed the direction of your work? Because you had 45 years of your work with, you know, the animals living in their world and writing about that and sharing that with the world. And then you went go ahead.
No, I was going to say it was a bit less than that. It began in '60.
Okay.
And it was in 1986.
Okay.
That's
so 26 years, about 26.
Yeah, 26.
Okay.
Where you're coming from is the research at Gombe is still continuing. So it's more than 55 years now, and it's vibrant, and we're learning new things, and we've extended out to chimpanzee populations in other parts of Africa. So that's continuing. My relation to it is just keeping abreast of what's going on. And what changed me was going to this conference in 86 when it suddenly became clear, because it was chimp people from different parts of Africa, that everywhere where chimpanzees were being studied, they were disappearing. Why? Forests were being destroyed. Human populations were growing, so the habitat was declining. And all the other problems like the beginning of the bushmeat trade, the commercial hunting of wild animals for food. So on the one hand, that came out at this conference in a session on conservation. And the other big changer for me was a session on conditions in some captive situations. And that's, 5-foot by 5-foot bleak bare cages for our closest living relatives. Why were they there, imprisoned in medical research labs? Because their bodies are so like ours that scientists wanted to use them to find cures and vaccines for diseases which are otherwise unique to us, but not prepared to admit the equally striking similarities in the working of the brain, the ability to solve problems, the personality, the social needs, and particularly the emotions, happiness, sadness, fear, despair. We were not prepared, those scientists, to acknowledge those aspects of chimpanzees.
It's just, if you take the time, if one takes the time to observe them, that is so clear. It's just my husband, since the time we had little children, said, I just won't go look at any gorillas or chimpanzees or anything in zoos. They're not supposed to be in captivity. Very upsetting to him in those kind of situations, in a little tiny, cage. And he said, they look at us and they say, what are you doing? So I that's an emotional moment for me. I agree with you. What about what do you do? What do you, Dr. Jane Goodall, do to give you hope? Because I think at times, you've mentioned about the children, but the condition of our planet can be daunting. What gives you hope and inspires you to get up every day and continue to make a difference? You don't just get up, you continue, like you said, 300 days a year. You don't get up and just say, I'm going to not use a plastic bag today. What's at the core of that inspiration?
Okay, well, first of all, it's 300 days a year on the road, but the other days are also spent, you know, with writing about these things.
So there are no holidays when it comes to preserving the planet.
I don't know what a holiday is. People say, what do you do for vacation? I say, what's a vacation? But anyway, I've got four reasons for hope. And number one is when young people understand the problems and we empower them to take action. That is my greatest source of hope because, you know, they're getting out there and doing it. And that's why I want to grow faster. So any school, any people listening, please join us. Become part of this Roots and Shoots network. And like one young man who started Roots and Shoots back in 91 at Tanzanian, he said, one of the things I love is that anywhere I go in the world, even if I don't know a single person, if there's a group of Roots and Shoots, I find my family. I love that.
I love that, too.
Young people, number one. Number two, this extraordinary brain that we have. Intellectually, I think it's the explosive development of our intellect that makes us more different from chimpanzees and other creatures than anything else. I mean, just think, we sent a rocket to Mars and a robot crept out and it's still crawling around billions of miles away, taking photographs for us to look at. We know that that's not a hospitable environment for humans. So how come this most intellectual creature that ever walked the planet is destroying its only home? And we seem to have lost the wisdom when the indigenous people would make a decision based on how will this affect our people generations ahead. And we make it, how will it affect us now, the next shareholders meeting, you know, those that the criteria upon which we base sometimes major decisions. But nevertheless, the human brain is coming up with all this innovative technology. And that is, you know, if we actually went for it, rather than succumbing to the pressure of the big multi-billion corporations that want to carry on as usual because that's where their profits are with oil and gas and so forth. You know, these innovations are out there. And we as individuals can use our brains to try and create the lightest possible ecological footprint every day. And more people are doing that. And thirdly is the resilience of nature. The places that we have destroyed, that can come back again, given time or sometimes help. The animal species, plant species on the absolute brink of extinction that can be given another chance. That's why I love the last one book I did was called Hope for Animals and Their World. And every single story is absolutely inspiring. And I got to talk to the people who said, no, we will not let this creature become extinct. And that's inspiring. And then finally, there's the indomitable human spirit, the people who tackle seemingly impossible tasks and won't give up, people like Rachel Carson, who we began with.
Right.
I will use her as my end piece. But, you know, people like the other day in Canada, I met a man born with no legs, just one sort of foot-like thing, and arms off at the elbows. He was born that way with one thumb. And he just went around Europe on his own on the skateboard.
It's. I mean, you get to. Yeah, that inspires me beyond measure. So the indomitable human spirit. But talk for a minute about, you know, your thoughts on. Can there be a good big dog? And what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes like I had Myra Goodman on the show from Earthbound Farm. And they produce, the largest producer of organic lettuce in the United States and Canada. And then I had people tweeting to me that Mrs. Green had sold out on the little guy and the small organic farmer. Does big always have to be bad? Do we have some corporate giants? You know, you read about Chipotle and the work they're doing. And this is, you know, United States and Whole Foods. And then there's an article that comes out about Whole Foods, about they've compromised our trust. So do you have any examples of the good big guy? Does that make sense?
Well, it does make sense. And, you know, I'm continually being disappointed also by... And I think what happens is the companies, the big companies, start off very ethical and determined to stay the course. But like everybody else, they come up against economic problems. I think that's what compromises them. I do know that Unilever, for example, with Paul Polman, people say that within a few years he did more to change the ethical performance of Unilever than anybody else, and they didn't see quite how that was possible, but he did it. And he is an extraordinary person, and he does believe that the only way to feed the world is through small family farms.
Little spots of hope. I mean, we've got to have them. You know, I say on the show frequently, or after we get off the show, with great guests like you, it comes down to, if it's not about the money, it's about the money. I mean, greed and earnings per share and profits drive so many decisions. Another example, I think, is Aveda. I had...
Aveda is wonderful.
Yeah, the head of Cradle to Cradle Certification on the show. And if you can, you know, pass the tests for the rigorous standards that they set out for your certification, I mean, it's a good example of another giant that's, you know, cradle to cradle certified. Okay, what about the power of the people? This is what continues to amaze me. In my view, people already have the power in terms of, especially here in the United States, and I don't want to just be myopic, but we have purchasing power. So to me, there's activating your, you know, in your brain to understand that you have to live as a conscious human being. And also, we could have a great impact by supporting companies like Aveda, and there are many others. Is that one of the things that gives you hope? I just keep hoping people listen to this and say, I've got the power, I can make changes.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we have to also say there are vast numbers of people, and a growing number of people, I believe, in the U.S. and other countries too, who simply cannot afford to be ethical. And, you know, one of the major problems worldwide, there are three. One is poverty. Two is unsustainable lifestyle. Three is human population growth. Those three together. So in a rural area, the poor people will destroy the environment because they've got to grow food to feed themselves and their family. And in our, you know, urban societies, the poor people are buying the cheapest stuff, which is usually made unethically because they can't afford more. And especially if they start having large families, and particularly with this, you know, this awful, horrible fast food that is enabling them to buy food cheaply, but then it's giving rise to obesity with all its medical problems.
Fast food is to me one of the ultimate oxymorons. It's not food. Yeah. It's just fast.
It's just making people fat and lazy. And this is why, you know, one of the biggest global Roots and Shoots initiatives is planting trees and growing food. So even in the inner city, kids are growing bits and pieces of food, even in the classroom if they don't have any space outside.
And it's that little bit, even with the gap widening between the haves and the have-nots and the rich and the poor, there is something you can do. The Pollinator Partnership was on the show, and Lori said, it was Laura, she said, if you have an apartment, just buy a little plant at the local supermarket and put it outside so that you can help the pollinators. So there's always some little thing that people can do. And Dr. Goodall, I knew the time would fly, and we have about a minute left. It's like, oh my gosh, 30 minutes with Dr. Jane Goodall. Thank you again for taking the time to be with us, for your important work. And I want to say that on our part, with our reach and our Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, we'll be talking about Roots and Shoots, and we'll be part of the movement that you have such a great vision for.
And thank you.
And I don't know if you heard, but in the next half hour, we'll be interviewing Lisa Carter from the Captain Planet Foundation. They will be honoring you with the Exemplar Award on December 5th, which, by the way, is my birthday. So I thought that was pretty cool. And we'll be hearing about the important work of that foundation. So thanks to you, and thank your staff for being so wonderful to work with. And needless to say, I hope so very much that our paths cross again someday in the important work that you're doing and the important work that I'm doing to try and get the word out about global visionaries.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And make sure, enjoyed our conversation.
And make sure you thank everybody on your team. You have a lot of people making your life work, and they are amazing. Everybody.
Yeah, the Jane Goodall Institute, that is.
The Jane Goodall Institute. Everybody, yeah. Dr. Jane Goodall, stay here with me for another exciting half hour. Welcome back, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And thank you, everybody, who has joined us today. I hope you enjoyed the first segment as much as I did with the unbelievably impressive Dr. Jane Goodall, and that you're ready for yet another wonderful segment for the second part of our series, Eco Heroes to the Rescue, highlighting the global impact of the Captain Planet Foundation. Our guest for this segment is Lisa Carter-Jones. She is the executive director of the Captain Planet Foundation. Since joining the organization in 2012, which is not that long ago, she's been really busy. She has helped them to successfully launch Project Learning Garden, the Leadership Center Science and Environmental Stewardship Programs with the Georgia Department of Education, and the Planeteers Club Program. She is a respected speaker on sustainability, environmental stewardship, and youth education programs. Most recently, she spoke on the Farm to School panel at the International Farm to Table Symposium, which is really a big deal, everybody, and moderated the panel on environmental education at the 2013 Clinton Global Initiative annual meeting. Lisa has a BA in communications from Wake Forest University and executive-level involvement with industries ranging from organic products to nonprofit management. Lisa, you stand on your own. You've got a lot behind you, and you're doing a lot. So let's get on with the show. Quite an impressive background, and thanks for taking the time to be with here to round out this segment.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I thought I'd do the philosophical aspect first, and then on to some of the concrete work you're doing. Because last week we heard from Laura Turner Seidel about the important work of the foundation. Why do you so passionately believe in the work of the Captain Planet Foundation as a vital part of the solution for the planet and its health? What is your passion behind taking this big job you said yes to?
Yeah, well, I think, if we really want the next generation or continuing generations to be an informed citizenry who are fighting for the air, land, water, and natural systems that we all depend on for life, then I think that they have to have had some experiences in their childhood that connect them to nature and make them advocates for it. That give them a sense of empowerment and being part of the change, and that they're science literate and they understand how to think critically and argue from evidence and engage in projects that really move the needle. And there's some really interesting research out that's been informing our work lately that has shown that the way that we've traditionally taught about the environment is so doom and gloom that it's causing students more often to disengage and just sort of feel like, gosh, we're inheriting a ruined earth and, why even bother to recycle at this point, and that's a terrible legacy to leave. And one of the roles that the foundation has played so successfully for over two decades is giving educators the funding and the tools that they need in order to provide kids with actualized, hands-on learning experiences that have real environmental outcomes so they can look back and say, I did that, it changed this, and I'm going to do that again because I get it.
And it gets them excited. It's not heavy. Yeah. It's light. You see the results. And it really does touch all of the aspects of STEM in terms of education. So it's igniting their passions like ours is ignited by just getting them out there and doing it. So what about along the philosophical, stream, do you think we can literally afford to raise another generation without honoring and supporting the fact that every child really holds a key, and I mean every child, to solving the environmental problems plaguing our communities? We don't know which one, but every child, I think, holds a piece of it. What's your reflection on that?
Well, I think you're right. And yeah, I think we have to get past the place where it's just the students whose parents are keyed in and, you know, self-elect those kids to go to enrichment programs, or
right.
the kids key in on their own and go to enrichment programs, and shift it to see how do we get this kind of learning, how do we get this kind of experience embedded in formal education. And it's just part of their process. You know, there's wonderful new science and STEM programs that are getting put into curricular, the curricular programming that gives kids more hands-on project-based learning and helps them begin to understand how do they apply concepts in science and math and engineering design processes that they're learning in the classroom to actual relevant projects that impact their school, their community, and their world. And I think that's where, you know, we start to get the real benefits. That's where we get every child plugged in, because they've all gone through a similar experience.
And, you know, with my background before I was Mrs. Green and doing this preservation of the planet as my last swan song, we can't afford not to, like as a taxpayer, if we want to go there, because these kinds of programs, more and more and more research, will support the facts that kids stay in school, their grades improve, they miss less school, they have more likelihood of graduating from high school, going on to college. So it's not just about, isn't this community garden really cute? Isn't it great the kids are getting their hands dirty? There's so much more to it. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we consider a school garden an on-site learning laboratory.
Yes.
I mean, it's a way for kids to understand, again, those concepts that they're learning in the classroom and how they're relevant to the world that they live in. And, you know, one of the reasons why students drop out, why we have such high dropout rates when we do, is, you know, typically science and math where they're failing. And so how do we provide the students with relevant learning that helps them early on in their careers, plug in early on in their school years, early
right,
on in elementary
right.
school, plug in and understand, you know, why science is relevant to them, and that they're doing it every single day. They're just not calling it that, and really let those lessons bring to life their curiosity and their inquiry and their observation skills. And then they might pursue, you know, or be more aggressive with STEM learning later on because they don't unplug right away. And, you know, when we see particularly girls and underserved minorities unplugging, they're unplugging early. It's happening in third and fourth grade. So so how do you bring that world to life for them so that they stay plugged into to that learning and they are successful all the way through a career and don't drop out?
Right, and it's that critical thinking piece that you're instilling in them, kind of secretly getting them to really get into the critical thinking mode, which then, of course, transcends to whatever field of study they might want to pursue. So with the foundation, you've kind of taken it on, not kind of, you have taken it on as your job to give the students whose lives you touch, the change makers, you give them the tools, the funding, and the best practices to solve and implement their answers. How do you go about addressing each of those critical pieces to make sure it all continues to happen? Because that's a complex carbohydrate of things that have to be included, the components that need to be there for it to be successful.
Yeah, I mean, the lucky thing for us is, as a two-decade-old organization, you know, we've attracted a lot of really
right.
brilliant, relevant
You've
educators.
You've got it going on.
Yeah, they bring us such amazing projects through our grant making. And then we have the great luck to be able to go back to them and say, this is so cool. Let's model this
yes.
so that other educators can do it too. You know, so we, you know, we don't have to create anything. They're out there creating with their students the most amazing projects. And our task is really to take those and turn them into a replicable project that others can participate in and that they can access with tools, resources, and information.
Which is so critical, because if not, it's just a great experience for the kids that got to participate, and then
yeah,
life goes on.
Yeah. Yeah,
so you really figure
yeah.
out ways to integrate it and implement it other ways. You know, I think our listeners like some details about programs, and you've helped implement some of them. So would you share with us about a couple of them? Like, what is the Project Learning Garden?
Sure. So Project Learning Garden was the outcome of some research that we did on the over 750 school and community gardens that the foundation had funded during its first two decades. And the board really challenged the staff to take a new strategic direction and really go mine for best practices and resources and,
wow.
and see if there isn't a way to turn that back out as a best practicing operating program. And that's what Project Learning Garden is now. And we learned three really critical things when we were doing the research, where we saw gaps around the country in school garden programs. One of the biggest ones that we saw was that school gardens were often considered by the, particularly by the administrators, but often too by the educators, as extracurricular or after school.
Okay.
And what we wanted was to work with exemplary educators in science and math and social studies and language arts and health to develop lessons that were tied to the curriculum, tied to Common Core, tied to state performance standards. So what we were doing is replacing a worksheet, classroom-driven lesson with a lesson outdoor that's more hands-on, more project-based, more inquiry-based, like we were talking about earlier.
And
that was huge.
That's huge,
yeah.
Really huge.
Yeah.
From developmental assets and the ways that kids learn, you
yeah.
are incorporating many more ways so that kids can successfully learn. Well, that's amazing. Okay, and what else did you learn? That was gap number one. That's pretty important.
Gap number one, yeah. Yeah, gap number two was that if we were going to ask educators to start doing that, then we had to help build their capacity to do so. So there needed to be workshops and not just, you know, little sort of, you know, 1 hour dive-ins, but full day and a half long workshops where they could come in really as educators doing professional development, explore project-based learning, explore outdoor classroom management, explore how you use natural and living systems as a laboratory. And so that was something that we added in, and we've trained almost 600 educators in Metro Atlanta now.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, to do
yes.
that. And
okay.
it's really a fun process. And again, we learn from them every time we do that.
And it makes sense. It's like, you're asking me to do this. I don't even know a hoe from a rake. I mean, so it, really.
You know, or how do I keep the kids from going off in 100 directions?
Yes,
you know, what are
yes.
What are the strategies?
And when do I plant this seed? I mean, that's really such yeah. a valid point. So immersion in really what it is that's going to be expected for it to be successful. Okay.
Right.
What was gap number three?
And gap number three was summer garden management. So
okay.
the typical cycle would be that you'd have your spring testing, your CRCTs, right? And then there'd be 2 weeks left between the tests and the end of school, and the teachers would flock out to the garden with their students, and they'd plant a bunch of seeds and a bunch of starts, and then everybody would go home for the summer, and it would grow like crazy over the summertime. And they'd come back in the fall, and they'd be like, oh my gosh, look at that mess. We do not have time for that right now. We're just back to school. And they would wait until the winter came and it died back, and then they'd get out there, clean it all out, and then they'd go through testing, and then they'd plant a bunch of spring stuff, and off they'd go again. And so, it was just a terrible cycle that a lot of schools have gotten into. And you know, the school systems, the facilities guys were just like, oh, my gosh, you know, the gardens look terrible, and it's making us look bad because people think that it's our job. And so we really got together with a lot of different stakeholders here in the city of Atlanta, which is where we have been piloting and doing most of our work on Project Learning Garden in the early years. And figured out that there were lots of urban youth who were getting their certificates in urban gardening, and they needed a job that,
right.
where they could start to put those new skills to work. There were college students who were getting internships at food banks here in the city who were studying urban ag but needed a summer job.
Unbelievable.
And so we found a great funder here, the Arthur M. Blank Foundation, who was willing to help because they were trying to solve the food desert issue in the city. And the other thing that we recognized about the school gardens, in addition to, you know, needing to manage them so that they could really work for the schools, was that there was a lot of productive land that was going to disuse. And if we put it to use, we could probably produce a lot of great food for the food banks to use over the summer to offer more fresh, healthy food for their constituents. And so we put all of that together And last summer, we had 58 school gardens here in the city under management. And over the summer, they produced 1,000 pounds or 4,000 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables for the food bank. And the summer garden managers got paid a stipend all summer long to do that work. And it just works out beautifully.
It's amazing. It's what I call the green trifecta. And I used to ring the bell on the show sometimes, but it's like you just want to ring a bell. Bells should go off because it's an integrated approach. Yeah. And the students, the kids that are in college win. The kids that need healthy food that are getting food from the food bank win. The food doesn't get wasted. I mean, it's just it's a really incredible, complete cycle of growing and living. I mean, I'm just, where's that bell when I need it? It's really a bell ringer. It's really excellent. Thanks. And I mean that. It's wow. And you had so many stakeholders.
Yeah. And when the teachers get back in the fall, they write us the loveliest emails and notes to say it was so great to come back and have all of the fall harvest ready to go for tastings and lessons, and to have beds ready for us to plant so that we'd have our winter crops that we could do our tastings and our lessons with. So, I mean, it's just a much better process for us. And so, you know, our difficulty then becomes how do we illustrate that framework for other markets so that they can replicate that series of partners.
Right. Yeah. And from what I'm hearing about Atlanta, I'm getting ready to come there in a couple of weeks, is that you might be getting ready for longer summer growing seasons because some of the people in your office I was talking to, they were hysterical, saying they got dressed in their jeans and their long sleeve shirts and went outside and said, nope. And it was 87 at the end of October. So it's we're going to be making a lot of adaptations, I think, in the next 10 to 20 years around climate cycles.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, that's amazing. So that's the Project Learning Center. Then you've helped establish the Leadership Center. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Leadership Center was another outcome from that research project. And it was really going in and finding those exemplary projects we talked about earlier and turning those into replicable projects. And so it manifested in a couple of ways. One way that it happened was PBS and their show This American Land went out and actually filmed a bunch of our exemplary grantees doing the work. And then we were able to create lessons to go along with the filmed material. So it's about 4 or 5 minute segments. Really awesome. One is a group out in Tahoe that are were doing an endangered species project with the Lahontan cutthroat trout. They were doing almost like a trout in the classroom, and then the kids would go out and release and learn about their watershed, release the fry when they had fully grown, and it really connected them to that watershed and to that endangered species. And then there's another project up in Oregon, a group of students that were using a bioswale to solve for a flooding problem on their school property.
Wow.
And then a group of students out in Utah who were using GPS devices for a native and invasive planting project that was providing the fodder that the pronghorn and the elk and all the other ungulates needed for winter forage that was getting crowded out by an invasive species up on the
parkland. Doesn't it blow you away? I've been doing this 6 years, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. They're using a GPS device to figure out all of this. I mean, it is what you said in the beginning. This is the importance of what you're doing, the preparing our kids for the future. They're preparing me. Wow.
Yeah, and it's fun because, you know, a couple of those projects got us excited, and so we actually pushed back out to the market something that we started calling Ecotech Grants that challenge the educators to come up with interesting projects that really exploited the intersections between technology, STEM, and the environment. And we got some really cool projects back, and we did that with the Ray C. Anderson Foundation. That was a partnership that we did with them. And like one of the projects I'll just tell you quickly was,
I love it.
So after water robotics clubs are pretty ubiquitous now, right? So there was a group out in California that they were doing underwater robots, and they had been doing them for a while, but in response to the Ecotech grants, they decided to sort of swap the project out a little bit. So they took when the kids finished building their underwater robots, they then fitted them with video cameras, sent them out to look for pockets of pollution along the shoreline,
and
then they organized cleanups, and then they sent the robots back out so they could look at what they did. Well, that is a great example of integrating technology into the environmental service, right?
Yes.
Loved it.
Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
Really cool. Loved it. And it's totally replicable. Like, I was joking with one of my colleagues the other day, like, nobody should ever have an underwater robots club that they don't do that at the end. Like, it's the whole, you know, it really gives a point to the activity, you know, like, let's put them to work. This is a great way to put those robots to work. So,
and, you know,
anyway,
it's
really
so
fun.
Exciting. And these are the kinds of shows that teachers are taking my podcast and listening to in the showing them in the classroom. Because teachers that are excited about this, you know, they write to us and say, is it okay if we use the podcast for a learning tool? How excited would kids get about that? I mean, who?
Yeah.
Robots going underwater and the fact that they go back in. So that's, you have me really excited about that. It's awesome. Really awesome. And you said something, you know, I try to take notes so that we can do a great job on Twitter. So you said that the Ecotech grants combine STEM, technology, and what was the third thing that you said?
And environmental service.
Okay. So, yeah, I can't write that fast. See, that's why enviro service. Okay. But, you know, it really matters for us to get the word out about great shows like this, and hashtagging is the way, especially if we want to get young people. Okay, that's
absolutely
unbelievable. That's a 5-star, the Leadership Center. And I love the partnering with other foundations to maximize the impact and the, you know, cross-pollination that I assume goes on there. And then what about the Planeteers Club program? That was the third one I was going to ask you to highlight.
Yes, the Planeteer Club program. I do want to say, I just want to go back. This American Land, those episodes that they did.
Okay.
If you go to our website, there are classroom lessons, and then there are replication models. So if a teacher wants to do that with her own students or his own students, whether it's the full project or sort of a micro version, just
wonderful,
so that they can get their feet wet. But
this American Land on the website. No, that's really great information.
Yeah.
We have a lot of mommy bloggers that follow us.
Nice.
So this is the kind of thing where it's like, yes, check it out, and homeschool moms. You know what I mean? This is perfect for someone that's homeschooling. Okay. If there's anything else you want to say about that, please do. It's like, you know more than I do, and I want to get the word out. So that's really critical information to share.
Yeah, thank you. And all of our Project Learning Garden lessons are up online, and they're free. So anybody can download them and use them. If you have an existing garden, go for it. Yeah.
Okay.
So Planeteer Clubs was something that that a committee and a group of green builders and I developed when I was actually over as the executive director of U.S. Green Building Council, Georgia, before I joined Captain Planet. And we were working with a lot of schools around the state to aggressively remodel and retrofit so that their energy and water would costs would reduce, and they could move those dollars back over to instruction. And so my mom was an elementary school teacher my whole life and a principal later. And she had done a program where she had just simply done a lights off program in her school at the request of the superintendent to save some operational dollars without costing him any money. And so, you know, this was a woman who charged me a quarter when I left my lights on when I was a kid.
Lisa. This is a great story. It's the mom. Oh, my gosh.
The mom. And she said she went back to her school after that meeting with their superintendent and realized that they never turned their lights off. And she hadn't even noticed because she wasn't paying the bills, you know. So they did. She instituted a lights off program, 3:30 lights off. And at the end of the day, lights off with the janitorial staff. And at the end of the first year of it, the school system had saved over $80,000 just by them turning their lights off in the school. And so when we were doing that project with the facilities folks and really looking at retrofits, I called my mom and I said, am I remembering this story correctly? And she's like, yeah, you got that right. And I said, wow, you know, we're leaving money on the table if we don't ask the students to engage in occupant behavior programs that are going to also reduce operational costs. And so we created something that at the time we called sustainability, clubs, which was a terrible name for an elementary school because
right.
like, the younger ones were calling them sustainability clubs. Yeah. And so when I came to Captain Planet Foundation, U.S. Green Building Council, Georgia was kind enough to let me bring the program here and tie it into the Planetary Clubs episodes and into the, you know, all of the cool cartoon assets that Captain Planet Foundation has. And we turned it into Planetary Clubs and then sort of grew, you know. So it so they do energy projects, and around Halloween, the kids put on vampire capes and run around looking for vampire energy loads in the school. You know,
yes.
So where can they unplug and
phantom
and
energy? They
do air quality, no idle zones out front of the school, and they do water projects and recycling. It's just they really become the sustainability directors of the school and take action to change policy and change behavior.
I mean, they're really all amazing. And let's, you know, it's just like I feel like pressing pause. Sometimes I want the bell, and other times I want everybody to, like, take a deep breath. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And think about everything that Lisa just said about the impact they're having for our future. That's the way I look at it. It's a very selfish perspective for me. It's like they're helping to save my planet, and it really feels great to know that they're out there. Now let's talk a little bit about the event on December 5th, because mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful always to celebrate heroes. In some, you know, at-risk cultures that I've worked with, when that's missing, it's very it's a really big void. So this is how we decided to do. We heard about the Captain Planet Foundation Benefit Gala because we had Jane Goodall on the show, and she's going to mm-hmm. receive the Exemplar Award. And then we learned Dr. Marshall Shepard is going to win the Protector of the Earth Award. And I don't know, have you met Olivia and Carter Reese?
Oh, they're amazing.
Like,
yes.
They have been on my show twice, and we think they hung the moon. So they're going to receive the Young Superhero Award for the Earth. And if you don't mind, let me just tell you very quickly, in my last interview when I said to them at the end, you know, I'm not going to ask you what you'd like to see 5 years down the road. Just tell us something that you're hoping will shift in the next 2 to 3 years. And Carter says, well, I hope I'm taller. And it's what I love about my show. I went, Carter, of course you do. And what a great answer. I mean, I almost couldn't finish the show. So they are delightful. And I said, okay, so you were filming rhinos. How's that working for you? I don't know if I could do it. So I guess we have about 2 minutes left, and 3 minutes. They're all outstanding honorees. What an onerous process. Are you involved in the process of selecting 3 people? And these are wonderful selections. And what is it, the big mission and intention to have this? Is it just fundraising? Is it to raise awareness? This is a big job to do. I've been involved in big galas, and it's a lot of work.
It is. And our board is very involved in the selection.
Thank
of the
God.
Awardees.
Right.
Yeah, and so, yeah, thankfully that does not rest solely on my shoulders, and I appreciate that so much.
Because you wouldn't have been doing this interview.
The gala is all of those things that you just mentioned. It's really important. It raises 100% of our dollars for our small grants program.
Oh, my gosh.
And it also provides us with really great support for admin and staffing, which, you know, that's not something that funding partners tend to want to
right.
put their dollars towards.
Right.
So it's really critical for that. Turner Enterprises provides us with an amazing amount of overhead in all of our offices at no cost. And then the Turner Foundation gives us other operational dollars. So we are very lucky that when we partner, we're able to put 100% of those dollars into programmatic expenses. And the gala is a big reason for that, too. So, but other than that, it's that moment to stop, take a deep breath, and really recognize people who are moving the needle and give them thanks and an opportunity to tell a little bit more of their story to people who can, you know, hopefully help them take things
yes,
to the next level.
To showcase mm-hmm. and have them be an example. I have to say right now that we have 1 minute left and that your passion is contagious. I'm inspired by yet another thought leader for the planet. The call to action, everybody, it's okay if I make it, I think. CaptainPlanetFoundation.org. Get your kids to visit it, your grandkids to visit it, and consider making a donation to support their important work. Lisa, thank you so much for being on the show. I cannot wait to meet you. Coming up next week, Down to Earth, 7 o'clock, Jennifer Juan and Matthew Lewis, Tohono Autumn Cultural Center, and the Mrs. Greenswald Show, Faith Maloney, co-founder of Best Friends Animal Society, in memoriam of Pam Hodges. Make it a great green week, everybody. And Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
The power is yours.